Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we have two fantastic topics and guests to share. In the first half hour, we welcome Aaron Good, co-author with Peter Dale Scott, of a new article in Covert Action Magazine titled, "Was the Now Forgotten Murder of One Man on September 9th, 2001 a crucial precondition for 9/11? Talk about 9/11 historiography and some untold histories around those events. Later in the program, we're joined by English professor Adam Bessie. His latest graphic piece is called Going Remote, Flattening the Curriculum. We'll talk about higher education, community college, and technology in the classroom in a COVID-19 era. Stay with us.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. In the times for the master thief, confine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, in this first segment, we're going to take a deep dive into deep events and the deep state. Was the now-forgotten murder of one man on September 9th, 2001, a crucial precondition for 9/11? We're joined today by scholar Aaron Good. Aaron Good, of course, is no stranger to the Project Censored audience. He's a former political organizer and current teacher of history living outside of Philadelphia. He earned his PhD from Temple University. His dissertation was titled American Exception, Hegemony, and the Tripartite State, which explored U.S. foreign policy, state criminality, and the deep state. The reason that you all might remember Aaron Good is that he was the person that put together a fantastic historical conversation between scholar Peter Dale Scott and the great whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. And these interviews took place at Project Censored's annual conference a couple years ago. And in fact, if you go to projectcensored.org, you can see the conversation that we recorded that Aaron Good facilitated called Empire, the Deep State, and the Doomsday Machine. We'll link that actually in the program notes for those of you that want to go back and listen to this historic conversation between Peter Dale Scott and Dan Ellsberg. But why am I bringing this up? Well, it's because Aaron Good has written an article published recently at Covert Action Quarterly earlier in December, co-authored with Peter Dale Scott. So we want to get into this today, as it's a very important part of historiography around the events of September the 11th. So Aaron Good, after that rather longish introduction, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mickey. It's great to be here. And I miss your co-host, Peter Phillips, but it's great to be on here with you. As you know, Peter Phillips was on my dissertation committee. This article that you reference, it's really a Peter Dale Scott article that I assisted with. And he came to me a while back, or I actually reached out to him with some of my work, and he found that it was compatible with what he was doing and suggested that I might help him work on some unpublished material that he had, but that he didn't really have the energy to work on, because he's now in his 90s, and he also has been writing this book on the poet Milos, and has been doing a number of other things that are amazing when you compare that to most people who are 90 years old are doing. So Peter sent me these notes first that I looked over dealing with the assassination of Ahmed Shah Massoud, and I thought they were really fascinating, and I sort of put them away and didn't think about them for a while because I was finishing up my PhD and teaching, and I've got a son who's now 6 years old, so it's been pretty busy. But he suggested that we go back and make this into an article, and he had spoken to Covert Action Magazine, which is kind of an illustrious outlet that was defunct for a while and then revived in 2018, but originally founded by CIA whistleblower Phil Agee and some other people who had worked in intelligence and who had written for Counter Spy Magazine, which was founded in 1973 and ran until 1984. So this is a famous magazine, and I thought it was really cool to be a part of it. It's another reason to come here is to direct people to covertactionmagazine.com to check out the different articles there. We were also assisted by Jeremy Kuzmarov on this article, and he's written a number of things He did the editing of it, made other contributions, but he's written a number of things at Covert Action Magazine. In particular, I'd recommend people look at Stealing Mineral Wealth for Corporate Interest, which is about the U.S. in Africa around Congo, Rwanda, Uganda, and some of the chicanery there. So it was good to find an outlet with this storied past to put this article in. Now, the article is organized around five things that happened historically, some of which are more big picture, and then others deal specifically with this assassination. And then they all led up to September 11th. The first was the incremental encroachments and penetration of the U.S. military, political, and economic power into Central Asia after the Soviet Union had dissolved. In the mid-90s, it was discovered, or it was believed, that the world's biggest oil reserves were actually in Central Asia, around the Caspian Sea, and there were different articles about this in the mid-90s that came out talking about this. And with the Soviet Union in shambles, this was sort of a free-for-all, as recognized by some opportunistic people. The second development is, in order to kill Ahmad Shah Massoud, there was a letter of introduction drafted between New York and London, and it was used by the assassins to get a meeting with Massoud, at which point they detonated a bomb which killed Massoud, who was the leader of the Northern Alliance. That took place on September 9th, 2001.
I remember when this happened, it got a blip in the news cycle. I remember thinking at the time that it seemed to be very peculiar in terms of what was happening there, given the Taliban and the history of what had happened through the Clinton years. But anyway, I digress. Back to you, Aaron Good.
And I think that they covered it up for a little while. I don't know exactly if the news of it came out before or after 9/11. He died on September 9th, and they covered it up for a while in order to keep the morale of the Northern Alliance up. The things that Peter discovered about it is that the U.S. government, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence suggesting they would have had foreknowledge of the letter, which we'll get into. And another key point of this, which was lost by most people, is that Massoud himself, even though it was the Northern Alliance that the U.S. used as its proxy force when they went into Afghanistan after 9/11, Massoud was the main obstacle to that ever happening before he was assassinated, because he was a nationalist and he did not want the U.S. to be occupying Afghanistan. He wanted as much support from the U.S. or anybody that he could get to try to take over the country and overthrow the Taliban, but he did not want the U.S. to be occupying the country. Going on at the same time as this assassination, actually on September 4th, you have the introduction or the reintroduction or the revival of a plan for military action in Afghanistan. They're talking about going into Afghanistan ostensibly to fight terrorism, but that's problematic as well. And then later, on September 10th, which is after Massoud has been assassinated, the day before 9/11, they're already going forward on formal plans to invade and occupy Afghanistan. Now, there's a couple of things that I don't mention in the article, and we sort of took it for granted that a lot of the readers would know this, but I want to mention this. For one, after 9/11, the U.S. is not interested in the Taliban's offers to turn over bin Laden, which seems very significant. This indicates that the U.S. wants to go into Afghanistan regardless of bin Laden's presence there.
I just want to interject momentarily just because I know that you cite Stephen Call and the Ghost Wars. There's a whole history of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan going way back, even before 79 with bin Laden and so on. But a lot of that history is relevant, and it sets up a lot of the things that happen here. But the main point you're making right now is that the U.S. already was looking to get involved more heavily in Afghanistan prior to the events of 9/11.
And they had made, this was famously reported by Broussard and his co-author in a book, which I think was called Forbidden Truths, right? And it was eventually translated, but with some of the things taken out in a kind of strange way in English. But there were meetings that were held with the Taliban where they were negotiating about pipeline routes and other issues and trying to have some rapprochement with the West. And they were told, according to former Pakistani ambassador, that if they did not cooperate with the West, then the West would take military action against them. And that same guy, his name was Nike, or Nake, it's spelled N-A-I-K. And we didn't end up putting this in the article either, but I found a BBC article from very shortly after 9/11 where he called it perfectly, saying that some of these other bases that the U.S. has put into Central Asia are going to be used in Afghanistan. And he doesn't think it's going to even matter if they turn over bin Laden or offer to turn bin Laden, that the invasion will go on anyway. So there was a lot of pressure for military intervention in Afghanistan. And there was a bigger agenda on the menu than just bin Laden. It's the fact that we're still there all these years later. I think that it may have been about some pipeline routes and control of Central Asia initially, but I think as the Bush administration gamble over the energy heartlands of Central Asia and Western Asia turned into disasters with the Iraq war and now this Syria business still going on, that the objectives, in my opinion, have changed somewhat to Afghanistan's strategic location in the middle of what China and Russia are trying to establish, like a One Belt, One Road economic realignment.
There's also the potential multi-trillions of dollars of mineral deposits in Afghanistan that you alluded to briefly.
As I understand it, Pete Buttigieg has a map on his wall of Afghanistan's mineral deposits, which is strange artwork to have as a conversation piece hanging in your home. And another thing that we don't mention in the article, but also assume that people know, is that after 9/11, you also had, thanks to Wes Clark, we know this, plans for them to go on a regime change spree across the region.
Let's get back to the 2001 murder of Massoud. And of course, as you and Peter Dale Scott write, the U.S. invasion depended upon Massoud's murder. And then, of course, you actually go on to talk about CIA support for Massoud prior to this. It's a really deep story and has a lot of history to it. And again, that's why I'd like to remind listeners, we're speaking with Aaron Good, co-author of a piece with Peter Dale Scott in Covert Action magazine. Was the now forgotten murder of one man on September 9, 2001, a crucial precondition for 9/11? Well, it seems that the answer to that is yes. So please continue, Aaron Good.
So a key aspect of this is, how did the U.S. have foreknowledge of this letter? And this comes through the blind sheikh, Abdel Rahman, who had been operating in the U.S., who had been granted visas, even though he should have been on a terror watch list. He'd been given visas by government officials. And all indications are that this was in order to help him to recruit jihadis, first in Afghanistan. But, and this is another aspect of what leads to 9/11 that always gets minimized or forgotten, it's that the U.S. had utilized those same networks throughout the 90s, starting especially with Azerbaijan around 1993, and then used in Yugoslavia. They used them in Bosnia. In fact, the blind sheikh Abdel Rahman, his organization, this Al-Kifa Center, which was precursor to Al-Qaeda, they set up an office in Bosnia to recruit jihadis and coordinate jihadi activities. And this was part of the U.S. government policy to break up Yugoslavia, to put it as succinctly as I can. They were used in the Balkans. They were used in places like Chechnya and different places across Central Asia up till 9/11. And this continues right up to 9/11 almost. Kosovo takes place in the very late 90s. And this is after Al-Qaeda is already considered an enemy of the United States and a real terrorist threat. And they are working in Kosovo, Al-Qaeda, with the Kosovo Liberation Army, which is like some sort of mafia organization involved in organ trafficking and drug trafficking and trafficking of just about anything, I would imagine. And the Al-Qaeda person on the ground there was Muhammad al-Zawahiri, the brother of Ayman al-Zawahiri. A Sunday Times expose was going to come out in 2008, stating that, according to whistleblowers and corroborated by several sources, that al-Zawahiri was working in Baku, Azerbaijan, with U.S. officials to coordinate these jihadi activities from 1997 to 2001. Nafiz Ahmed wrote an article about this story that got spiked like 5 years later. He wrote this in 2013. But using the deployment of these jihadis for U.S. geopolitical purposes was going on all the way up through 9/11. 9/11 feeds into the same sort of agenda that was being pursued by these people. And this is left out of a lot of conventional histories.
I'd like to remind our listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. We're talking about a recent article published in Covert Action magazine. Was the now forgotten murder of one man on September 9th, 2001, a crucial precondition for 9/11? Our guest today is co-author with Peter Dale Scott. We're speaking with Aaron Good. He's a political organizer, a current history teacher living outside of Philadelphia, earned his PhD from Temple University. with his dissertation, American Exception, Hegemony and the Tripartite State. We're going to continue our conversation about some 9/11 historiography after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back scholar Aaron Good, who recently co-authored a piece with Peter Dale Scott. It's in Covert Action Magazine, covertactionmagazine.com. Was the now-forgotten murder of one man on September 9th, 2001 a crucial precondition for 9/11? Well, today Aaron Good is discussing that article with us and, well, seems to be arguing that yes, not only was the invasion of Afghanistan pre-planned and pretty much inevitable, but this event actually was a tipping point. And Aaron Good, before the break, you were talking about a lot of the issues with that and that stemmed from that. But let's dive back in. You mentioned Nafees Ahmed, and you mentioned certainly censorship around then. Nafees Ahmed wrote the foreword for our Censored 2013 book and, in fact, addresses a couple of these issues in it. But let's jump back in here because, again, this article actually covers quite a bit of territory for an article. There have been books written about multiple of these types of topics, including by Peter Dale Scott. So let's jump back in here with the foreign policy thread. Again, this isn't something that just happened on 9/11 and then, bam, these policies for the war on terror came up. This actually goes back at least to the 70s. You mentioned Brzezinski, the Grand Chessboard, others. Jump back in here and continue the thread, Aaron Good.
So another aspect of these operations was that from the U.S., people like Abdelrahman and his Al-Khifa Mosque were supplying jihadis and coordinating jihadi activities, first for Afghanistan, but then in the post-Soviet scramble for resources and dominance of the energy heartlands of the world, they were being sent, you know, all over the place in Central Asia and the Balkans especially. So eventually, Abdelrahman, the blind sheikh, ends up going to jail for his role in the Landmarks murder case, including the bombing of the World Trade Center and a slew of conspiracy charges. And he's supposed to be incommunicado because he's a terrorist mastermind. Of course, his communications are going to be monitored. And he had a go-between who was also wiretapped. And shortly after the Massoud assassination, it came out in an article that this postal worker named Sitar had been the go-between from the blind sheikh to other Islamists. And so this person passes on this information about a letter, and they mention this in the press that there's a discussion overheard about the drafting of a letter for a secret mission in Afghanistan. The blind sheikh issues the order, apparently, and Sitar passes this information on to this fellow named Al-Siri, who runs an Islamic center in England. And Al-Siri ends up being the person who gives this letter to other people who go on to murder Massoud. But it seems very likely that anybody listening to these conversations that are being referenced here in the Times would have known that the only target that this would make any sense for in Afghanistan would be Massoud. And so the question is, did they let this go forward? We think that there's a strong circumstantial case that they did let this assassination happen. And another thing that suggests this is the way that it's covered in the press later, because there are no stories about the blind sheikh and his involvement in this after the initial ones. But strangely enough, I found some other articles about Al-Siri, one of which is around 2013 and like maybe in the UK Independent, one of those main British papers. And it says, oh, he admits to drafting the letter that ended up killing Massoud. Well, eventually there's another sort of official story that comes out about this murder. And it stems from a computer that was found by a Wall Street Journal reporter, supposedly, in a bazaar. He needed some computer repairs, and he finds a laptop. And the laptop basically has a treasure trove of Al-Qaeda documents and so on, including the letter that was used to kill Massoud. But this letter was written by Muhammad al-Zawahiri, reportedly, according to these files, which of course we only hear reports on from the media, people use that to say that, oh, bin Laden must have ordered this assassination. But that's actually very thin. There's very thin evidence about that. And in fact, it's contradicted by, if al-Siri admits writing the letter, why would Muhammad al-Zawahiri, why would he be on this computer that a guy happens to find in a bazaar in Kabul? This is a pivotal historical thing, and the way that it's not been delved into is what Peter Dale Scott would call a negative template, meaning that it probably indicates that it's significant and that we should pay attention to it. So he came up with this idea of a negative template to describe the way that the Warren Commission omitted Jack Ruby's organized crime connections in relation to the Kennedy assassination. It must be significant if this is just being sort of vanished when it's obviously relevant to the story. So the computer episode shows you the power of the intelligence agencies when things like this can be used to affect historical narratives, but it's information of dubious origin. And the only way that we hear about it is from a top-down black box of the state and their intelligence agencies saying, oh yeah, this is what it says. This is what my mind turns to whenever I hear about allegations of Russian hacking or anything like this, that we need to recognize one of the weaknesses of our liberal democracy, quote unquote, is that we have these agencies that don't really operate according to democratic principles of openness and transparency and so on. We're really captive in some ways to these entities.
Let's wrap up about this story. I definitely want to get around to the conclusion you all have in terms of September 11, 2001 as an historical black hole. It looks like there's stuff that should really seriously be investigated.
This time period leading up to this, there was controversy under Bill Clinton and his administration about what to do in Central Asia. The Secretary of State, Strobe Talbott, who was an old friend, he said that the U.S. should not be involved in the great game here, that we should not be trying to go into this region to take over, that we should have cooperation that would allow everybody to benefit. But if you look at what the U.S. has done since 9/11, that idea of everybody wins, let's have a world of cooperation, that is just not the path that American foreign policy went on.
It's the opposite.
And, you know, China, for all of its faults, at least puts that out as a model of, we're not going to overthrow you or invade you. Let's do business together. Now, Talbott and the State Department under Clinton was urging that the U.S. take this more moderate course, not imperialist course. But in the meantime, people like Cheney, Rumsfeld, and people in the CIA really wanted the U.S. to become more involved there. And anti-terror operations dovetail with energy policy. But it's notable that these terror operations and these terror networks are popping up in places that are very advantageous to the projection of U.S. power.
Particularly Cheney and Bush in the oil industry. And let's not forget Hamid Karzai, who later becomes the head of state in Afghanistan, who was with UNICAL. But curious people and curious characters here that maybe appear to be, you know, supporting past, but they end up having a pretty central role in the bigger picture.
The outcome of this is that it ended up that Central Asia didn't have the energy reserves that they initially thought. But the region takes on more importance because of, like, today, China, Russia, Iran, Afghanistan sits right in the middle. These failures in Afghanistan and Iraq are being wound down. So this episode seems to be part of the winding down of a Pax Americana, where we go for world domination. And this is a really relevant article. I recommend you go and read it. We're really blessed to have Peter Dale Scott still out here. And I was really thrilled to have been able to help.
Aaron Good, in conclusion, almost a flip side historiographically of Francis Fukuyama writing on the end of history. Here you and Peter Dale Scott are basically saying that possibly some of these foreign policy failures, you write here, quote, may be a sign that decades of so-called Pax Americana with oil-related aggressions against states from Afghanistan to Libya are winding down as well. Do you see that as a major shifting point in policy, perhaps moving forward? We're coming back into a neoliberal Joe Biden administration here. What's the tack here?
Well, I think that the elements of international cooperation and avoiding imperialist entanglements that was represented by Strobe Talbott, even in the Clinton administration, that element seems to have been gone from the Obama administration. And Obama was really more the third and fourth terms of George W. Bush. He prosecuted wars in Libya and Syria, which were on the Bush regime hit list. and even used Al-Qaeda forces to affect these outcomes here, which is kind of astounding. So I think that Biden may be a return to another Obama/Bush administration. But the other aspect of this is that the U.S. is not as relatively powerful as it once was. Russia and China have more influence in this region. And so the U.S. may be limited in what it can do militarily. And so hopefully reality is going to force the U.S. under Biden to avoid anything that's too reckless or dangerous for the world. I really hope that that is the case.
Aaron Good, your former political organizer, current history teacher living outside Philadelphia, recently earned your PhD from Temple University. The article that we've been discussing today, Aaron Good researched and co-authored with Peter Dale Scott, who's the former Canadian diplomat and poet who's written many important books on the CIA and so-called deep state, including Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, The War Conspiracy, The Road to 9/11, American War Machine, and the American Deep State. Aaron Good, your article with Peter Dale Scott is titled, "Was the Now Forgotten Murder of One Man on September 9, 2001 a Crucial Precondition for 9/11? This is published at covertactionmagazine.com, and I think a very important historiographic contribution to the history of 9/11 and U.S. foreign policy and Pax Americana into the 21st century. Aaron Good, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you very much, Mickey.
Up next on the Project Censored Show, we're going to switch gears and we're going to talk about everything from education and technology to where we're going in 2021 in the Biden administration. We're going to be joined by Professor of English, Adam Bessie, longtime contributor to Project Censored, and we're looking forward to the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're shifting gears to education, technology, and the new Biden administration. We're joined by Professor Adam Bessie. Adam teaches English at Diablo Valley College in the San Francisco Bay Area. He writes comics in collaboration with illustrators that have appeared in national outlets such as The New Yorker, The Boston Globe, The Los Angeles Times, and more. Adam won the New York Association of Black Journalists 2018 award for his graphic essay, Betsy DeVos, School Choice Movement Isn't Social Justice. Adam lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with his wife and son, and he is a full-time community college English professor. And Adam Bessie is also a colleague of mine at DVC, as well as a longtime contributor to Project Censored. Part of what we're discussing today involves a couple of pieces that Adam Bessie did with us at Project Censored this year. One of the pieces appears in Project Censored's new book, Project Censored State of the Free Press 2021, called Going Remote, Flattening the Curriculum. That also was published earlier this year by Truthout, and we'll reference that and link it in the program notes so you can see that. And of course, Adam Bessie and Pete Glanting also did another piece this summer for us at Project Censored that's online at projectcensored.org called Pandemic Pod People, Invasion of the School Snatchers. So you'll see we're going to be getting into education, technology, and more here with Adam Bessie. Adam Bessie, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me back. I'm talking to you from my teaching bunker, which I imagine many fellow educators have too, a converted half garage. I can see my lawnmower in the other room while I'm talking with you on Zoom right now.
I'm right there with you in the office bunker. So we're in similar locations. You've been dealing with and talking about higher education, technology, critical pedagogy for quite some time. Let's talk about what we're experiencing right now as educators and what is the topic of the piece in the new Project Censored book, Going Remote, Flattening the Curriculum. Let's talk about higher education, community college in the age of COVID. Let's just start there.
The title Going Remote is very intentional. I'm an English professor, so I'm very interested in language and being precise in my language. And remote in this context has two meanings, obviously, in terms of literally in March, we all went remote in the course of a week. This is a remarkable thing to consider that, you know, a small percentage of community college classes were online. That was part of our college. But come by mid-March, early April, everybody was online. The entire system was remote. Not only that, but of course, all the K-12, like my third grader was online on using Google Drive, using Zoom. And this was the first time any of us were subject to what a New York writer called the Zoom school experiment. So all of us in spring suddenly found ourselves in a space entirely mediated by Silicon Valley technologies within the course of a week. For me personally, I had never taught online before on purpose. I'm an on-ground person. I like the jazz of the classroom, the feeling of being with students. I'd used Canvas and other technologies to supplement my instruction, but really I was an on-ground teacher and I still am one. But of course, due to COVID, there was no other choice but to be in this remote space. I felt often, to use an overused metaphor, I was building the plane every week as I was flying it, putting up new modules, trying to figure out how to do a Zoom. And again, through this entire spring semester and into fall, the entire experience, it's very strange being in a public institution, and yet all of it is based around technologies that are for profit.
Outsourced to private for-profit corporations that make money through data mining, through having access to us and our students. This turns into a rabbit hole really quickly. I'd taught online for over 15 years. Not that I'd preferred it, but I had started as an adjunct and saw the writing on the wall, wanted to have those skill sets. But look, online education has changed drastically just in the last half year. This is not the same kind of online education we've seen. And you just mentioned, Adam Bessie, something that we want to get into here. And that is the role that this private for-profit Silicon Valley kind of invasive technocracy, technopolistic, as Neil Postman would say, has infiltrated the public sphere through education, and in many ways creates anything from the idea of Milton Friedman to pedagogical Taylorism, a whole host of things. And one of the prisms you came in through literally was the Zoomification lens of higher education. So many things to unpack there.
The first definition I gave just a second ago is this idea of literally we're using remote technology. The second thing I was really exploring, and I wrote this comic in the spring, and I can give observations now that I have more experience. But as I wrote Going Remote in the spring, I was thinking a lot about this idea of the medium is the message, Marshall McLuhan. The medium in which you teach is, in a way, what you teach. And that's why I loved face-to-face so much, in order to be with those students. But even then, in a face-to-face classroom, there's a medium to that classroom. And it's organized by an industrial logic. So the classrooms are like, there's a certain amount of time, everyone shows up at that time, right, together. Everything's sequenced by units, by a course, you get a grade. It's all very quantified. So even in the original face-to-face medium, there's a lot of that industrial logic, which goes all the way back to Frederick Taylor and his assembly line studies. So mass education early on being framed as sort of mass production. So even within face-to-face, even then, there's a medium there, and we do our best to humanize that. Now, what medium is Zoom? For me, this was a very new medium and a very, very new way of experiencing education with my students. And so I think it made me particularly reflective about what is the message that the technology sends to the students. And the tool of Zoom, which Mickey and I are talking across right now, is a particularly interesting one. So in the comic, I started to think about what is the message that the student gets by interacting with their teacher in a little box. And so immediately, because I write in comics form, not humorous comics, but graphic novel in the tradition of Joe Sacco, Art Spiegelman, Alison Bechdel, many, many others we can get into later, inspired by them. You know, I said, well, you know, it's so funny. The Zoom window kind of looks like comic panels. And I said, that's really interesting. When I'm looking at my class, there's 30 of these boxes. It looks like the page of a comic book. And yet each little panel is as a portal to another person's life. right? And so I'd be looking at that screen, and people weren't just sitting down and talking. Some people were like washing the dishes. Other people, I had one student that was in her van that I think she was living with her father in there. People were in their car driving, and then half the screens were all black. The symbolism also, not just of a flat black square, right? The students are literally each of them in a box, but also that they're muted. And I just thought of the message of that, that the student is now literally represented as a box, and oftentimes a black box with a muted sign. And I often had to say, unmute yourself. As we all know, that's sort of the catchphrase of 2020, unmute yourself. And that medium, to me, even though it really was, if we wanted to have face-to-face conversation, that was the way to achieve it, pretty much, unless you want to use another competing technology that comes from the same Silicon Valley ilk. But I said, the medium of this technology really, ultimately, it flattens everyone. And I take this concept from, I want to give a big shout out to Nick Susanis, who wrote an amazing book that was very inspirational to me called Unflattening. And it was his dissertation that was published by Harvard, and it's a graphic novel dissertation. And the whole purpose of that book, which is cited and referenced in Going Remote, is about the ways in which our educational systems serve to render people two-dimensional rather than three-dimensional. And I thought, wow, Zoom literalizes this. This author, Susanis, was talking about flattening in a face-to-face classroom in terms of the way the teacher interacts with the student, in terms of the way testing, standardized testing operates. And now with Zoom, this is quite literally a flat panel. And so that really was the subject of my inquiry in Going Remote, is thinking about what is the message that Zoom is sending on this maybe subconscious level that none of us are aware of. How does it make us understand education now, but also how does it help us understand how education has always been? And that led me to thinking about, if we can start to really see the problems and the flatness of this media, maybe it will make us reflect on other ways our school systems have been flattened and flattened our students. And we can seize this crisis as an opportunity to make education more human, because we know that many of the corporate interests in Silicon Valley see this crisis as an opportunity to increase the spread of these technologies. Those plans are happening, obviously. And in the same way, it's like, well, how do we as educators seize this moment in order to make policy and classroom changes that humanize the space? So that's what Going Remote was. It is a reflection on the medium and the moment of COVID teaching, and how can we, as people interested in creating critical and imaginative three-dimensional citizens and people, how do we seize this moment to make those changes that have been long due in our public education system?
These are long due. In fact, it seems as though the challenges that we're now facing have just simply been exacerbated by COVID and by going remote, so to speak, and the significant now. There was already extraordinary reliance on tech software and these kind of things, but now it's just jumped the shark tank entirely. We're doing something totally different. From Taylorism to the whole Milton Friedman privatization issue, we just saw Betsy DeVos now finally out the door at the Department of Education. We do, as you said, have an opportunity now to re-envision some of the things that we should have been doing in education anyway. The challenge here is that we've been heading towards this technocratic lack of a critical pedagogical system, more of a Tayloristic kind of pedagogy. Metrics, measurements, outcomes, teaching to the career track. There's a whole host of things we're going to crack open here maybe in a little bit, specifically about the technology of this. But everything from surveillance valley to algorithms of oppression, there's a lot of problems with the technology that even we're using now and relying on, and the vulnerability that it puts our students in. And so that's another whole layer of what's going on in higher ed. If you want to go to college, you have to use this technology. If you want to go to college to get a job, you've got to now sign off on all the dotted lines. You've got to sign off on all the agreements. A lot of people that are teaching aren't telling their students what the consequences are for having to use this kind of technology. Can you comment on that, Adam?
Part of my work is I work with one of our crisis teams on campus, where we get cases that come through. with students that are dealing with problems. And I can tell you, and I'm sure Mickey, you too, and any teacher working community college, we know the community college population tends to be more vulnerable. Many of them, whatever background they are, haven't had the guidance maybe of someone that their parents have gone to college. Economically, most of our students are working class people. They're working people. Many of our students may be in immigrant families where they're translating for parents. Our community college students, we have such a diversity, but for many of them, they're not what you'd think of as the traditional 18 years old, I'm going off to college, and that's all what I'm focusing on. Many of our students are really an integral part of their household, and they're being asked to step up in COVID. Now with COVID, they have to work because their parents have lost their jobs. Their situations are precarious. And as part of my work with my students, and as part of my work working with this crisis program, I'm seeing students that would barely cling on during the best of times now are just falling off more easily. And the question is regarding technology. Now, of course, without some of these technologies, we can't even interface with the student at all. There would be no school. I often think, I've thought about this, if this were 1999 or 1989, what would we do? So there's that. These technologies are requisite. But because they're requisite, and this is a line from the comic, community college has no admissions requirements. Anybody can come in. And that's the beauty of the institution. However, now if everything is tied into the technology, then admission requirements are tied to the software requirements. So de facto, the software is setting who can get in and get out.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I am your host, Mickey Huff, and we are speaking with Professor Adam Bessie about going remote. We're talking about higher education, community college, and big tech. We're going to take a quick musical break, and we're going to come back and continue. So please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are delighted to be in conversation with Adam Bessie. He writes comics in collaboration with illustrators that have appeared in national outlets from the New Yorker to the Los Angeles Times. He's published with us, of course, at Project Censored in a number of ways over the years, including most recently in our newest book, a comic on going remote, higher education, and where we are in the COVID era. Adam Bessie, just before the break, you were getting into something that was a very significant development in terms of the access to education, community college. We're now talking about additional hurdles or additional challenges, not just economically, but technologically. So please continue.
The purpose of community college as designed is about access. And it's such an amazing system. And I've traveled a lot and read a lot. I can't think of any other country that has such a system that really invites everyone from wherever they're at. Originally, online education was about giving access to students who otherwise wouldn't be able to. Working people, folks with disabilities, parents. Pre-COVID, online education was critical to achieve the mission of giving access to everybody. With COVID, it problematizes the situation. You can't have college right now without these platforms. But at the same time, what are the consequences and costs of being on these? And one of the ones that concerns me most, again, goes to access. Obviously, the more affluent students will have better access. And you might say, well, almost everyone has an iPhone or something. Well, an iPhone gives you access, but it gives you the same access as someone that has their own room in their house where they can study. They have stable Wi-Fi. The person doesn't have to work, as opposed to, I can't tell you how many students I talk with, and again, teachers that are listening, you know this, many of the students are sharing because everyone's living together now due to economic crisis. I'll see like two or three people in one room trying to work. That student's having to work themselves. They have very little time to make it work. And again, if two or three people are online, their Wi-Fi is slow. Sometimes I've had students that disappeared for 2 weeks because the bills couldn't get paid. And so now that we're in this realm where online is not additional, but mandatory, there is a definite equity social justice issue. As I was preparing for this interview, I just said COVID capitalism. I don't know if anyone else has said that. I feel like teaching right now, I've really been able to see what's happening economically much more clearly. For example, I had a student that is a single mom and got COVID. What happens in that situation, right? And so we see the intersection with healthcare. I can't tell you how many students got COVID, and it knocked them out, not just in terms of missing classwork, but they missed work that they needed to do in order to help their parents. So when I speak of COVID capitalism, I'm just kind of making it up on the fly here because I haven't thought too much about it. I think it's just a time of increased scarcity. And we see that the scarcity that already existed, teaching community college, you already see that scarcity where people are really trying to get themselves a better life than they've had. And they work very hard for it. But here, it's even more scarce and things are even more precarious. The student I just mentioned that got COVID with three kids, not only is the student missing work, but how do they connect their school with the healthcare? It's a mess. And many students are just getting sick once or one thing away from just completely dropping out. As opposed to, again, many students who come from privileged areas, if they get sick, people are taking care of them. They can bounce back from that. My great concern is what threat COVID will pose in the present come spring semester in the long term in terms of achieving that mission of universal access.
You know, as you mentioned earlier, on the flip side, there's this opportunity, but it seems like the challenges are more profound, and not just for students, but also, of course, for educators. Don't want to leave staff and administrators out. Everyone's struggling. Everyone's making an effort here at the community college level to serve students. But it seems like, not to use more military metaphors, but front lines talk. And what's curious about that front line is that it's now mediated with a screen.
And I want to be real. It is frontline emotional work for many of the teachers. I could tell many stories about students that are just so profoundly struggling, but that's not unique. And that's emotional labor. A lot of us and the students are just utterly exhausted by this process. And so it's hard for us to take a step back and reflect on how to take action, especially when many of these problems are really larger social network problems. So for example, when you work in this space, you see the clear connection between funding of education, between funding of healthcare, between the social safety net. The students that don't have healthcare are going to be much more impacted than those that are. And so the problems that we're facing are problems that colleges alone just simply cannot solve. We need to have reform that really focuses on healthcare for all, on better funding. We need a holistic way of thinking about education that doesn't atomize education away from the rest of society. And that's, unfortunately, the Bush era and Obama era race to the top technocratic policies really had the effect of saying, you know, here are these failing schools. Let's ignore the fact that they're in extremely impoverished areas, and that's probably the reason that they're struggling. Let's also ignore the fact that the tests are not culturally appropriate. So the whiter and more affluent you are, the more successful you'll be. And so unfortunately, we have a legacy of considering the schools as sort of separate from the community. We need to have a profound rethinking of the role of the community and community schools.
And look, Adam, Bessie, I know that Diane Ravitch, of course, screams to the forefront when you're talking about this and the good work that she's done over the years on education and issues with education, quote unquote, reform. Betsy DeVos is out. We hear very recently that the Biden administration has actually picked a new person to head up education, Cardin from Connecticut. Could you talk a little bit about maybe a little bit about that source or a little bit about what you hope that you might see moving away from the DeVos privatized model?
First of all, just thankfully DeVos was so incompetent, she couldn't really move any of her items forward. Because if she had, she would have continued to increase segregation and other things and privatization much more successfully. But there was no coherent agenda. I think with DeVos was kind of the purpose, just to put someone there that would destroy the Department of Education. And we really do need a Department of Education to guide us in particular directions and have a vision for where we should go. And so in terms of the current pick, Cardone, I've talked to some of my sources that are in the like progressive education community. I've done a lot of reading on it. And he, as with lots of Biden's picks, is a safe pick. And that's what I've heard from Randy Weingarten, not directly, but through her tweets and through my own reading. And what I mean by safe is that he largely has not been involved in the battles of the last 20 years about privatization, standardization. He certainly is way better than DeVos, but that's a low bar.
I just wanted to interject very quickly to make sure that our listeners knew that we were speaking about Miguel Cardona. That's the educational secretary pick from Connecticut, right? Was education chief in Connecticut. And again, as you're mentioning, Adam Bessie, in educational circles, there's already been a lot of talk about Cardona and what that means for the moving away from DeVos.
I think Biden did not pick a known figure within these debates. There are known figures. And I read Ravitch a lot for this. There were other picks that were vehemently anti-charter, did not go that way. Also did not bring in a former Obama person. And I think for someone that's interested in education, that was one of my key concerns is he simply going to go back to normal, this normal of technocratic top-down management? And I would say for me, the answer is unclear. I like the way that Cardona talks. I mean, he's interested in achievement gaps and equity, and he talks that language. However, I would say a lot of the language under which Race to the Top and No Child Left Behind were sold was with social justice language. A lot of the ways in which these reforms were sold to the public was that it was the right and anti-racist thing to do to standardize the curriculum and to close schools. So I think we'll have to see moving forward. I don't anticipate the kind of large-scale radical change. I'd like to see where there's a rethinking of the school systems as part of the community. But I think certainly it seems to me that we're moving a better direction, clearly, than DeVos, and hopefully than we saw under Obama, that we've finally seen this technocratic thing.
Cardona is younger, in his 40s, I believe, was raised in a working class kind of environment, went to city schools, was a fourth grade teacher, became a principal at a younger age, is bilingual. Certainly things that lend to maybe understanding what the average public school experience is for many diverse students in the United States.
That's what gives me hope as well, is that Arne Duncan, who was the Secretary of Education, he was like an executive. He's not like a teacher. And so for a long time, we haven't really had someone that comes from our ranks. And so there's been a longstanding real feeling, and I think I speak for many educators confidently, of alienation with the Democratic and Republican parties and feeling like there's folks that are not even talking to educators setting policies. And so my hope is that now that we have someone that has come from a background from which many of our students come from, and as someone that is interested in these issues and has been a teacher and has worked in the community, that will portend a better direction. But especially with COVID, the forces of privatization are very strong. And just like after Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, Milton Friedman said, this is a great opportunity to reform the school system. And indeed, it was entirely charterized. My concern is that there are many venture capitalists that are going to be exerting a lot of pressure to standardize some of these technologies that we've been discussing. Educators need to be really paying attention and being on our feet about what's going on, to watch what the new Secretary of Education does, and to be really insistent that we continue to move in a direction where we treat children and our students as whole people.
Well, we'll certainly be watching Biden's pick, Miguel Cardona, in education. We're almost out of time, Adam Bessie, and unfortunately, I am going to spring a question on you that is going to be a teaser for another entire segment on a future program, but we want to wrap up with it. Comics as a key medium for change, that's something that you have spent a lot of time doing with your writing, your creativity. course, Going Remote with Pete Glanting is a latest iteration of a graphic that you have in the newest Project Censored book. But very quickly, comics is a key medium for change. What can you tell us?
Comics for change. Yeah, I mean, I always loved comics since Mad Magazine. And Mad Magazine, very early on, was a critical view of 50s America. And the reason it was a magazine was because it couldn't be a comic because they were banning comics. There was a whole commission on juvenile delinquency to stop comics because there was a recognition of the power of this visual medium to make change. A wonderful book on that is by David Hodgeu called The 10-Cent Plague. But why is this so powerful? Well, honestly, a lot of the stuff we're talking about is very arcane. When I was just writing essays on this, I feel like the same people were just reading it. And if you're going to make any change, you've got to get a broader conversation. So to me, comics are a democratic medium. You open up the Project Censored book, you're like, what is this? I should look at it, maybe. And maybe you glance through it, and then it's a gateway drug that pulls you into maybe reading some of the things we've cited. So my goal with comics is to broaden the conversation and have more people involved in talking about these issues that really have been cordoned off to folks that are in the elite.
Well, Adam Bessie, I'm afraid that's all the time we have, but that's a fantastic note to end on. And I'd love to have you back on a future show to focus on that specific topic. And you've got a wealth of experience with it. Our guest today has been Adam Bessie, professor of English at Yavapai College in the San Francisco Bay Area. He published most recently a piece with us at Project Censored and our newest book, Going Remote, Flattening the Curriculum, with pictures by Pete Glanting. Also, Pandemic Pod People, Invasion of the School Snatchers, is at projectcensored.org. And Adam Bessie, is there any way people can follow you, contact you, or see more about the wonderful work that you do?
Pretty easy. It's just my name, Adam, A-D-A-M, Bessie. You look me up on Instagram, on Twitter, which I don't use much. I don't really use much social media, but you can find me or my website. So just look my name up and you'll find my stuff.
Absolutely. And you're also at projectcensored.org, truthout.org, and many other places. Adam Bessie, as always, it's great to talk with you. And thanks so much for all that you do in education and for our students. It's greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Mickey.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show, founded in 2010 by myself, Mickey Huff, along with Peter Phillips. I am the executive producer and host of the program. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. The Project Censored Show airs on roughly 50 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more, you can go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us at Project Censored on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. To learn more or to contact us about ideas for shows or feedback, you can find us at projectcensored.org. Last but not least, we'd like to thank all of you for tuning in. We've been on the air for 10 years and looking forward to 10 more with all of you. Stay well, and here's to a better 2021.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Times running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu.